Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
And Ken, we are here to handicap the big game, the Super Bowl, the summit on health care between President Obama and Congress.
The name of this podcast is It's All Politics. Now, there is health care involved here, and there are serious questions about the nation's health care system. But there's also serious questions about the nation's political system and whether that works.
Can this political system tackle a problem like health care? The policy complications, the enormous costs, the long-term interests that are different from the short-term interests, the fact that Americans know we need something different in the system, something like 60% say they think that there ought to be big changes made in the healthcare insurance system. And yet at the same time, almost 60% of the people say they don't like the bill that's before Congress right now. How do you reconcile that?
Well, if you're Barack Obama, you support the view of the American people that the system is not working, that it's just too expensive, the eligibility requirements are just ridiculous out of hand. If you're the Republican Party, you talk about how much it'll cost you, about taxes, about all the bugaboos that are out there about what the Obama plan, radical or incremental, whatever it is, what it means to the American people. I think there's unanimity out there that it's not working. The question is, how do you fix it? This is something that's been vexing presidents since Truman. This is clearly as close as we've ever gotten to changing something. And yet, listening to the political spin back and forth from both sides, you feel that we haven't gotten that far at all.
I'm wondering, too, if what we have here is not a case of an unpopular bill that contains a lot of popular ideas. A lot of these ideas actually date back to the Republican alternative to the Clinton plan in 1993 and 1994, put together by John Chafee and a number of other Republicans. So this is not the radical approach that many Democrats would have preferred. So in some respects, what's being rejected here is not the substance of what's in the bill. What's being rejected is the idea of the bill coming from the Democrats and being, in some sense or another, imposed on the Republicans who are in Congress now. And this is a different Republican cast.
That's the key point, that exactly that, because the Republican Party you talked about in the 70s, 80s, the John Chafees, the David Durenbergers, they don't exist anymore.
That is correct.
There is an Olympia Snowe, there was a Susan Collins, and maybe there's even a Scott Brown, and we could talk about his role, his new role in the Senate. But for the most part, this is a much more conservative party, a smaller party perhaps, but a certainly more ideologically driven. And unlike what you have with Bill Clinton and a Republican Congress or President Reagan and a Democratic Congress, you have control in one party. I have a sense that the Republicans resent the fact that this is Democratic Party driven, and they feel powerless, but they're not so powerless that they can't bottle up the bill.
That's why there is this enormous irony here, which is that the Democrats have, in a sense, too much power in order to pass the bill. If they had fewer seats in the Senate, fewer seats in the House, it is entirely possible they could have negotiated something with the Republicans that might have been passed last fall. But because they had so many votes, they flirted with the idea of writing a bill that would be more to the specifications of the average Democrat, and they flirted with the idea of a 60-vote majority in the Senate, which I think was always a mirage. They never really had 60 votes. They only had a nominal 60 that was there some days, not some days, and which empowered individual Democrats and independents to hold hostage the whole health care bill whenever they felt like it.
I suspect that one of the reasons for this summit is that President Obama has been looking at the headlines saying Democrats disagree with each other, Democrats can't get their act together, and said, wait a second, let's have it where we're all sitting together and we'll show a united Democratic front against those heartless Republicans. The problem is there is not a united Democratic front. Certainly if you look at Nancy Pelosi and you look at the relationship among Democrats in the House, They passed it last November 220 to 215.
They gave a lot of people a pass. They gave an awful lot of Democrats a chance to vote against it.
They did, but again, you still have a different dynamic. You have John Murtha, who is since deceased. You have Bob Wexler of Florida, who's since resigned. This week, Neil Abercrombie of Hawaii is resigning to run for governor.
They've got fewer votes. They have noticeably fewer votes.
They have Joe Cow, the one Republican who voted for it from Louisiana, says he will no longer vote for it. And then you have the question of what to do with the Bart Stupaks of the world, because when President Obama on Monday announced his version of the bill,
Obamacare 2.0,
right, combining the best of the Senate and House versions,
which was mostly the Senate version,
but it also does not include the Stupak abortion language. Now, Stupak says, I will not vote for this bill. The question is how many pro-life Democrats he brings with him.
I think he's saying something in the neighborhood of 20. That could be enough to be fatal, given some of the other Democrats who would probably vote against it. That would include Blue Dogs. It would include people whose district voted for John McCain. There are Democrats whose district voted 55-60-60-some% for John McCain in the presidential election of 2008 and voted for a Democrat for Congress, but might not do so again
in
2010.
Even if they voted for 60% for John McCain in 2008, the Republican brand was far weaker in 2006 and 2008 than it is in 2010. November may be another story, but for right now, that Democratic optimism that seemed to be sweeping the nation, sort of like baby fish mouth.
Baby fish mouth! Baby fish mouth!
Seems to be, at least in the wake of Massachusetts, New Jersey, Virginia, the Tea Party stuff, it's not the kind of enthusiasm we saw a couple of months ago.
And nonetheless, despite all that dynamic, which we've been talking about through the latter half of 2009, really pretty much beginning with the August town halls, despite all of that, there are people who still think a bill will be achieved through one means or another, probably using a simple majority in the Senate through the budget process, and that includes that word reconciliation, which is a process that's been used before, as Julie Rovner did a brilliant piece on NPR this week that's been widely quoted, pointing out how often reconciliation has been used to do difficult things, specifically with respect to health care. So that is an option that the Democrats have, and it is possible they could get something through the House and the Senate. Still, it's not all over with yet. And one reason for that, it strikes me, is that the Tea Party energy, the town hall energy, may have in some sense or another peaked. And its results may be a little bit more mixed than we originally thought.
I'm not sure if we can say that we've seen the best of the Tea Party influence. I'm not sure if that's the case. But there are serious risks to the Tea Party enthusiasm for the Republican Party. It's one thing to say, you know, let's all elect Scott Brown. But you notice this week on the jobs bill, when Scott Brown was one of five Republicans to vote against to stop the filibuster on Harry Reid's pretty modest $15 billion jobs bill, and suddenly the hero, the guy who was cheered like crazy last week at CPAC, is now Benedict Brown. He's a Judas. He's a traitor.
This is my point, that the pure energy of the Tea Party is an against energy. It is pushing back against what was perceived for a while to be this juggernaut of Democratic power in Washington. If you've been around the last few months, you notice that the wheels have come off that juggernaut. There is no huge push of Democratic power. The bills that passed through the House last year have stalled in the Senate. So the Tea Party energy is going to go off in a number of different directions. And as we saw in the jobs bill, once they got past the cloture vote, 70 people voted for this thing. There were only 27 Republicans and one Democrat who voted against the jobs bill. So put cloture aside, which I think is, again, going back a few minutes, the power issue. The Republicans saying, don't count us out. Once you get past the power issue, there's a lot more consensus on some of these issues than you might otherwise think. 70 to 28, for example, on the jobs bill.
Now, that jobs bill was certainly good news for Harry Reid. Obviously, the Democrats want to go to the voters in November and say, look, we have passed this. And as you say, that Harry Reid expects more votes on more jobs bills. But I suspect that what the five Republicans did was not the kind of heresy that some Tea Party people suggest. There's a big talk about bipartisanship, and the five Republicans, Scott Brown and George Voinovich and Olympia Snowe and Susan Collins and Kit Bond, the five Republicans who broke the filibuster on the jobs bill.
Two of whom, by the way, are retiring.
Right, two are retiring, and there are a lot of conservatives, there are Tea Party supporters who say that this is heresy, that they betrayed the Republican Party. My argument is that they almost made it better for the Republican Party. Look, we will go with you if your cause is right, and we show that we can be bipartisan. But at the same time, you have to give little to us as well. Perhaps that was the message to President Obama this week.
I think at least both parties want to have some street cred as being interested in listening to the other side. It's too clear that the people dislike the idea of the two parties being utterly on different planets. They would like to see them working together in at least some measure. So suddenly everyone's at least trying to get a little bit more of that credibility back. But you made a point earlier about where the energy of the Tea Party might go, and we're going to see some of this in just the next few days in the Texas primary.
Once upon a time, Rick Perry was the establishment. He's been governor of Texas longer than anybody in state history. You think that he's worn out his welcome, but there is a rejuvenation of conservative movement, and somehow, I guess if Kay Bailey Hutchison has become the true establishment figure there, the Washington establishment, Rick Perry can assume the mantle of the outsider.
He was at least Austin establishment, which is more Texas, and Kay Bailey was Washington, D.C. establishment, where she has been now for a very long time.
Even though she has done so much for Texas, brought so much money to Texas.
But it's this intra-party symbolism. Right. Right. But then arises a Tea Party representative, if you will, or at least somebody who's a beneficiary of that energy we've been talking about, Deborah Medina. She's a rancher, she's a housewife, she's a mom, she's a homeschooler, and she is very much part of the, if you will, libertarian almost, Ron Paul.
She used to work for Ron Paul.
Exactly. She may not be a straight line Ron Paul person on a lot of economic issues, but she's tapping into the same energy that caused Ron Paul to be the number one finisher in the presidential preference straw poll at the Conservative Political Action Conference last weekend.
There's always been a difference between the libertarian slash Ron Paul people who are very effective online, on the internets, and the lack of same results in primaries and caucuses. Certainly in primaries in 2008, Ron Paul did not make a difference at all.
It was so amazing, in fact. We were up in New Hampshire, and you would go to these debates between the candidates, and you would go out in public, and there would always be an absolute sea of Ron Paul supporters and their signs, and they seemed to be such a movement. And then on the actual primary day, they virtually disappeared. And it turned out they were never that numerous. That was always a surprise, I think, to a lot of grassroots people to see that the Paul phenomenon melted away when it actually came to counting votes.
That's why a lot of people are watching to see how well Deborah Medina does on Tuesday. Of course, if no candidate gets 50%, it goes to an April runoff. I still suspect that Medina finishes third in Tuesday's primary.
I don't think there's any question.
But I mean, if she could go 20-22% or something.
She denies him an outright victory. And then we have another round, which really, you know, he probably wins the runoff eventually. But it's another month of campaigning. It weakens him further. And I think the Democrats are probably daydreaming when they think that Bill White's got a real shot at this in
the
November.
Former mayor of Houston.
Yeah, right. This is 2010. It's not going to be a great year to be a Democrat practically anywhere, and surely not in Texas.
You know, 4 years ago, just to remind everybody, Rick Perry barely survived a four-way re-election battle with 39% of the vote. But, of course, 2006 and 2010 regarding Republican fortunes are night and day.
Speaking of night and day, how about another major figure in the Republican Party, John McCain? John McCain was the party nominee in 2008, has been one of their headline personalities for many, many years, suddenly fighting for his life in a primary back in Arizona.
As popular as John McCain had been, certainly he was more popular with the media in 2000 than he was in 2008, but he still only was very popular in the Republican Party. But the more conservative elements in the party, certainly in Arizona, never liked him. They don't like his views on immigration. They don't like his views voting against the Bush tax cuts. They don't like his views on
And he voted against
finance.
Those tax cuts because he wanted them to be paid for by spending cuts, and they weren't, and that's why he voted against them. It's not like he's against tax cuts.
True, but they was against the Republican president, and a lot of Bush loyalists never forgave him for that. The thing that's most interesting is that in his 24 years in the Senate, this is the first time he's being faced with a primary challenge of any kind, let alone from the right. Now, the problem for the opponents of John McCain is that you have a very flawed candidate in J.D. Hayworth.
Who lost his own House seat very badly in 2006.
Who was involved with Jack Abramoff, who took a lot of money from Jack Abramoff, and he's kind of a bombastic guy. But if you're tired of John McCain winking at the conservatives while winking at the national media at the same time.
If you're just tired of John McCain winking.
Period. Right, exactly. There's J.D. Hayworth. I still think that McCain has been very aware of this challenge. He's, as a matter of fact, he always talks about the left-wing Barack Obama agenda. He is not taking his battle for re-election for granted. First of all, there's not even a Democrat in that race, or at least not a Democrat of any significance.
Not of any credibility.
So I think he knows that he has not pleased many people on the right over the last couple of years, and I think he's moving more to the right to kind of push J.D. Hayworth way out of the picture.
All right, here's another night and day situation. A federal prison inmate now running for Congress. Isn't that the reverse of the usual process?
Usually they go from Congress to prison.
Yeah, James Traficant is the fellow we're talking about, the extraordinary, some would say thuggish character from Eastern Ohio, who was at one time a sheriff, who was in all kinds of different trouble with federal government.
An indicted sheriff.
Was an indicted sheriff, rescued himself, in a sense, politically, by running for Congress and getting elected and becoming, as you would, a self-styled tribune of the people, a sort of populist without party, but was always a Democrat. Now he is out of prison, he's got his hair back, and he is running for Congress again. And not as a Democrat. Why?
Well, because he wants to be the heir apparent. I mean, I think if I use that joke one more time, that'd be trouble. Even though he has been a Democrat, as you say, all his career, he is, in a sense, a kind of a Tea Party kind of candidate, anger at the IRS, angry at the government, angry at government intrusion from a Democratic populist point of view.
Or what we used to consider a Democratic populist point of view. Now with a Democratic government, I suppose it could all be seen as anti-Washington, anti-Democratic, anti-Obama.
Yes, and that is James Traficant to a core. Now he says he's going to run for Congress in one of two districts. His old district was kind of ripped apart in the 2002 redistricting.
Because of the population loss in that part of the state.
Right, right. But interesting, though, in 2002, when he was already in prison, he ran for Congress as an independent. He was already kicked out of Congress, and he got 15% of the vote. So there is support, some kind of a support for Traficant in eastern Ohio, but after 7 years in prison, you wonder how much of that remains.
Some of that 15% might dwindle.
Perhaps running as an independent, as Jim Traficant says he will do.
Well, he'd have to, right, because the deadline has already passed for filing in either party.
The filing deadline is over, but I suspect that he would always do better as an independent, given his appeal to Tea Party activists disaffected from both parties, and that's what Jim Traficant has always been about.
But could he throw the race in that particular district to one party or the other?
Well, that's the question. If he runs against Tim Ryan, the guy who succeeded him in his old district, no, because that's really a Democratic district. If it's Charlie Wilson in the old Ted Strickland Appalachia social conservative district, that could help the Republican Party. But still, it's all about Jim Traficant, as it always has been.
Ken, we started today talking about health care and the health care summit and the health care bill and that issue. But let's talk about health care in the specific instance of a couple of pretty high-profile American political figures who were in the medical news this past week.
Dick Cheney, the former vice president, who actually last week was, you know, had them on their feet at CPAC saying Barack Obama's a one-term president. He suffered a mild heart attack on Monday. His fifth heart attack started, his first one was at age of 37.
That's right. But he had the others in fairly rapid succession after the first one. So this is the first heart attack he's had in many, many years. And that's what's disturbing, of course, to his doctors and his family. He's only 69, which sometimes comes as a surprise to people because he seems to have been around forever. He was chief of staff at the White House when he was 35 years old back in the mid-70s. He should have many years ahead of him if he can overcome these heart problems.
But you know that another leading Republican, former leading Republican in the hospital is Bob Dole.
The Republican nominee for president in 1996, prior to that, was Senate Majority Leader for a number of years. In fact, here's a little-known fact about Bob Dole. He was the leader of the Republican Party in the Senate longer than any other Republican has ever been.
I did not know that. Now, Bob Dole, of course, this is not about his heart. It's more about his knee. But Bob Dole is 86 years old, and he's had some tough health problems over the last couple of years as well.
Dole has had a history of hospitalization and problems, mostly associated, of course, with the war wounds, the grievous war wounds that he suffered at the end of World War II, fighting in the 10th Mountain Division, despite the fact that he came from Kansas. He then, of course, went into a public life and had a long, long political career.
His injuries, obviously his World War II injuries, I think, are basically behind that prickly personality he's had. I think he always felt that others were handed things, he had to work for them. But you know something, there's a new feeling about Bob Dole in latter years. The anger seems to have gone away. Of course, he's now 86 years old. But he's a beloved figure in the Republican Party. And he has expressed many times he almost doesn't recognize what's happened to the party since he left.
Both Cheney and Dole, at one time or another in their careers, were cast as the Darth Vader of the Republican Party. You know, the mean guy, the bitter guy, the tough guy. Bob Dole was called a hatchet man when he was in the Senate and defending Richard Nixon. Later on,
76 vice presidential debate with Mondale.
Exactly. And that when he referred to the Democrat wars. And then in the 88 contest against George Bush, after he had lost the New Hampshire primary, you remember him angrily saying on national television, "Stop lying about my record." So when he had finally left politics after his defeat to Bill Clinton in 1996, Bob Dole did a series of public appearances, some on behalf of products and others just in sort of various public fora, establishing himself as more of a figure of fun. And he had always been a very funny man. When he was Senate Majority Leader, he often said things that literally had the Senate spontaneously laughing.
There's almost like a crossing of paths between Cheney and Dole, because initially, when Dick Cheney was in the House, and even as Secretary of Defense under the first President Bush, he was kind of a likable, approachable person. Something happened to him when he became vice president. He became surly. He doesn't talk to the press at all. He became very angry, whereas the opposite was Dole. Dole became the cuddly grandfather.
it's true. Cheney hardened as Dole softened.
And well, we certainly wish Dick Cheney, Bob Dole, speedy recovery.
Indeed we do. That's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.